I'm Katie, riding the number 11 bus on Lincoln Avenue, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Katie. Enjoy riding the number 11 bus. Hopefully it's getting you to where you need to go on time, safely and soundly. This is Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 782. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Of course, you can always say hello online. We're on Twitter, where all good conversations go to die. I'm a little salty with Twitter these days. I don't know. It's not exactly a place where you can have nuanced conversation, but we're on it anyway. So there you go. At Outside the Loop is the handle. Instagram, Facebook. Oh boy, Facebook and Instagram facing their own issues. What is going on? But hey, the podcast, that's still cool. The podcast of the show, available for you for free wherever you get your podcasts these days. Be sure to download the show. Also, check out the website, OutsideTheLoopRadio.com, for all 15 years of the audio archives. You could also check out WGNRadio.com. We say good morning to Bob Ferguson, who is the engineer on duty in the WGN Radio studios today. And, you know, I was recently in the Wicker Park neighborhood, right by where I used to live. And, boy, I lived there for probably, I don't know, 13, 14 years. And I feel like in that area, you just kind of get used to things. So first of all, in the Wicker Park area, you got used to more people because when I moved in there around 2004, 2005, there weren't as many people living there. You had to get used to more buildings, more restaurants and bars, which isn't a bad thing. It's just, you know, getting a little bit more crowded. You also got used to the vermin, the rats. And I know that Chicago has, for years, had a rat problem. And I did not know this. I had to look this up. I was thinking about this earlier because when I was recently in Wicker Park, I went through an alley and it was one of those encounters with the rats where you're not sure if that is like a raccoon or if that is a rat. And it turns out it was a rat. And it was like a rat that was roided out because, oh my goodness, this thing was huge. So I did some digging, and apparently, I did not know this, but earlier in the year, for the sixth consecutive year, Chicago was named the rattiest city in America. The rattiest city in America. That's according to our good friends over at Orkin, the pest control company. So they apparently took a survey. They did a survey, and Chicago's number one, the rattiest city in America. And one of the strategies, yes, there has been poison and, you know, close the garbage bins. But apparently, the Treehouse Humane Society has placed over 1,000 feral cats onto Chicago streets since 2012. I did not know that this was a strategy. We're putting wild cats out there. And I guess it makes sense, but they're going to be patrolling alleys, patrolling Chicago for rats, which, hey, look, I'm all for. I don't need to see the steroid-induced rat in the Chicago alley. I don't need that kind of standoff. I don't need that kind of stress. We're still in a pandemic. No one needs that. What we do need is a quality radio program, and that is what we are delivering for you today. We'll talk about a brand new brewery opening up. It's a black-owned brewery called Funky Town. Also, we will take a look at affordable housing in Chicago and the secret history of Chicago music, learning about a country rock band from the 1970s and 80s and still going here in Chicago. This is Outside the Loop. Mike Steven here along with you. Rats, stay out of my alley. There are about 9,000 breweries operating in the United States, and of those, around 70 are black-owned. Last Saturday, Funky Town Brewery became the second black-owned brewery in Chicago to open this year with its official launch party. Co-owners Richard Bloomfield, Zachary Day, and Gregory Williams are here with us today to give us the lowdown on this dream come true. Guys, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to have you here.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, look, I mean, brewing in Chicago and just being a craft brewer, that's a really competitive business. It's really tough to do, as I'm sure you know. So tell us the origin story here. Why did you decide to open a brewery, especially today when, you know, there are one or two others out there?
Back in 2017, you know, we like just took a trip to Thailand. It was amazing. We were sitting back home in the summer, kind of reflecting on that and like trying to figure out what is more, like what is more for us? How can we bring more into our lives, more experiences? And, you know, maybe actually follow that dream of financial independence on our own terms. So like, we were probably just like sitting around drinking some beer, like let's go into business for ourselves. What do we do? What do we like to do? What are we interested in? And since we were probably drinking craft beers at the moment, like it was an instant link. So like from the very start, we said, all right, we're going to start home brewing. And our whole goal is to go pro. So like that was like maybe in July 2017. By September, we put some funds together and bought all the home brewing equipment we needed to, all grain, by the way. We brought all the home brewing equipment we needed to get started. And from there, we just practiced. Starting with some beginner classes at Brew and Grow. We just kind of kept at it.
And so you kept at it. You loved beer. You love craft beer. And so fast forward, that was back in 2017. You're home brewing and the opportunity presents itself to actually open a brewery, a proper brewery. And that's sort of the origins of Funky Town. And this is a black-owned brewery, right? I mean, this is significant, especially because the brewing industry isn't incredibly diverse. It could use more diversity, but I think it's interesting that, and really great that part of Funky Town's identity, I mean, you're putting that black owned image front and center. That's really part of who you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In 2019, we actually had an experience that really let us know that this was a viable path for us. The festival is no longer, but it was called Fresh Fest. And it was the first like kind of national black craft beer festival. And it was held in Pittsburgh. We went down there in 2019. Even outside of just like the beer sampling, they had like seminars set up. So you can kind of learn about the ins and outs of the business. And these small black brewers from all across the country come together and share thoughts. And then we went to the event itself, which I think the USA Today, by its second launch, USA Today launched, considered it the second best festival in the country. So there were a ton of people out there, like 20-something black breweries from across the country represented. And the information flowed freely, like how to start this business with little access to capital. How was your start here on the East Coast? How was your start on the West Coast? And basically, we came back from that event just motivated, and we learned about what contract brewing was. We actually did not know that at the time. We actually thought we were just going to somehow build up this idea and get the banks to give us a bunch of money to open, you know, open a brewery, buy equipment, and purchase a building.
Right.
But contract brewing allows you to kind of prototype it and kind of create a proof of concept, and it's like a lower capital, a lower barrier to enter the industry. So that information all came from Fresh Fest, specifically Alyssa Bowens Mercado, a black woman brewer in Connecticut that runs Rhythm Brewery.
So here you are in Chicago. Let's talk about, you know, being here and what this looks like. So Funky Town Brewery, are you a actual brick and mortar place yet? How do we get your product? What does that all look like?
Well, we partner with a pilot project, like Rich mentioned before. So yes, we do have some avenues within Pilot Project. They've been very helpful in this partnership. So yeah, typically we do have the brew on tap and also in cans at Pilot Project and then some other stores such as Beer Shop in Oak Park, Garfield's, Maria's, and Beer Miscuous.
So those are some spots where we could pick up Funky Town Brewing's beer. And in terms of like where you're doing this, now you don't have necessarily like a tap room open, but you have a space in Chicago where you're working out of?
Correct. Our stuff is brewed over at Pilot Project. Sometimes you'll catch us over there hanging out. We work with the brewers there to scale up the homebrew recipes that we create. That is our location for now. The whole goal is to eventually get up, you know, use this kind of as a proof of concept that Funky Town belongs in Chicago. Black beer companies can thrive in Chicago and that black people in Chicago want to drink craft beer. So this using a Pilot Project as a brewery incubator, they'll be able to kind of help us get our brand message and our product out on the streets so that we're eventually able to go to the bank and ask for enough money to purchase our own spot so we still at our own location.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we forget about the business aspect, right? I mean, that's it's fun to brew beer, but boy, it is a business, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Very expensive.
So you guys, originally from Oak Park, you went to Oak Park River Forest High School. I teach at Oak Park River Forest High School. Look, kids, you can brew beer when you get older. This is an inspiration story.
Yeah, it's definitely something that we wanted to make sure that we represented. We want to make sure that we represent new avenues. We want to make sure that we represent something different, maybe that young folks haven't thought of. And that's kind of due to the fact that we haven't necessarily been included in this industry. You mentioned at the top, like it's less than 1% of breweries in the entire nation are black. And for three guys who graduated from Oak Park, a diverse community that we can show kids, not only just in Oak Park, but, you know, the surrounding areas, the surrounding Chicagoland areas, that it's not just sports you can get into. You know what I mean? It's something, goals that you can reach and things that you never thought you could accomplish. What we're trying to do is just make sure that this is visible to them, because who knows if it had been visible to us, you know, as teenagers, or, you know, we're not supposed to be drinking as teenagers, but if we just had that visual in front of us, like, hey, there are these black breweries over here. Maybe this is something that we can get into when the time is right. So just to be a success story up until this point for the Oak Park community is a huge thing for us, because we're rooted here no matter where we come from originally, because Greg is originally from the west side of Chicago. And me and Rich are originally from Oak Park. Greg moved here, what was that, fourth grade? You know, that was a large part of his, Oak Park was a large part of his maturation process and what he learned to see and how he learned to grow. So us being able to just kind of give that back and be a visual for young kids, especially young black kids, especially minorities, even women, you know what I mean? So not just something that we're trying to do just for our culture. Of course, ours is in the forefront, but we also want to just highlight minorities. We also want to highlight women, because those are often overlooked and underserved as well, too.
Look, I love the story. I think what you're doing is great, and I'm excited to try your beer. Here we go. Can't wait to pick up some of Funky Town Brewing. And we can go on to Instagram. Your handle is at funkytown_brewery. And for now, that is where we can get all the information for Funky Town Brewing. The co-owners, Richard Bloomfield, Zachary Day, and Gregory Williams. Guys, I am really excited for you to see where this all goes. I'm happy you're getting in the mix here in Chicago. I'm excited to try your beer. And guys, best of luck with everything in the future. Thanks for talking today.
No problem. Thank you for having us on.
Appreciate you.
A 4. affordable housing is disappearing on the north side of Chicago. That's according to a new study from the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. With us to talk about this report is Jeff Smith, who is the executive director of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University. Jeff, welcome back to Outside the Loop.
Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. So a lot to sort of unpack here. So, okay, let's talk about affordable housing. At the outset, Jeff, what are we talking about when we say that term, affordable housing? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, housing affordability very broadly is defined as a housing unit that's affordable for the individual renter household at 30% of their monthly income. So if you're paying more than 30% of your income towards housing costs, then you're paying, you're considered to be an unaffordable unit. So obviously the levels of affordability vary based on your income ranges. So for this report, you know, essentially we're looking at households earning an income of about, 50% of the area median income, which translates to about $33,000 a year annual household income, would be considered like a lower income household looking for affordable housing. And therefore, an affordable rent for that household would be, around $900 a month.
You know, that term affordable housing, and I appreciate you breaking it down for us there, but I think that phrase is also very loaded, especially when you look at some of these neighborhoods in these communities that we're talking about, that we will talk about when we discuss this report on the north side of Chicago. That term affordable housing really evokes, I think, an emotional response, because when these proposed affordable housing developments are on the table, I feel like people kind of come out of the woodwork and say, not in my neighborhood. It's like an emotionally charged issue as well.
Well, I think another great point is, housing affordability has a lot of, it's a bit murky in some ways in terms of how it's defined. And so we, kind of look at it as, have capital A affordable housing, which is, housing that has some type of subsidy associated with it. So there's a unit of housing unit, the government, some government financing program helps finance that unit. And therefore, the income of the renter is restricted for a period of time. So that's sort of government assisted affordable rental housing. And the reality is that that type of affordable housing makes up a relatively small portion of the overall rental housing landscape. But you're right that when, when a development is proposed in certain neighborhoods and people hear that there's an affordable housing development proposed for this site, the neighborhood gets all up in arms, and it does evoke, an emotional response in a lot of parts of the city. The reality, though, is also that, there's a small A affordable housing, which is really just low cost housing that doesn't really, is not attached to any type of subsidy. Its affordability is, the product of the fact that it's in an older building, or it's in a neighborhood that maybe is not a hot neighborhood at that point in time, or the owners have owned the property for many, many years and they're not necessarily looking to maximize the profit that they get from that unit. They're just, interested in finding good tenants. And so that type of, kind of lower A affordable housing makes up the vast majority of rental housing in Chicago, the vast majority of lower cost rental housing in Chicago. And so, when we look at the loss of affordable rental housing, it's really that segment of the market that we're focused on, because, on the other side, the capital A side, there's a government subsidy that is requiring that unit to be affordable for a certain period of time. So it's relatively stable. Mm-hmm. It's that other side that is vulnerable to market shifts, be it, rising prices, rising rents, rising demand, or whatnot. So that's really the segment of the market that we're focused on in many cases. But they're both, they both make up kind of the big picture of what affordability is in Chicago.
So digging into this report a little bit, between 2012 and 2014 and 2017 and 2019, overall, the city lost about 5.2% of affordable housing. But if you break it down and look at what neighborhoods this is really impacting, Logan Square and Avondale, that area of Chicago, lost the most affordable housing of any submarket in Cook County. I think it was around 14%, if my numbers are right there. What's going on in Logan Square and Avondale?
Well, that's, that's the sort of that whole, those north side neighborhoods are, undergoing, fairly dramatic and substantial, you know, increase in housing costs and in investment. So what you're seeing in those neighborhoods is that, you know, those kind of small A affordable rental housing units, you know, they're owned by, you know, large landlords, small landlords, but low cost units are being lost. And, you know, the way that those units are lost, quote unquote, is affordable. It could be that the owner sees that you've got a lot of higher income people interested in living in the neighborhood, and they decide, well, hey, we're going to increase rents to, you know, meet that demand. And that's totally within their rights to do that. Or long-term owner has owned the property for 20 plus years, decides, well, hey, you know, I don't want to own this property anymore. You know, for whatever reason, I want to move to Florida. Property taxes are too high. I'm just old. You know, whatever the case may be, they decide they want to sell their property. The new owner, you know, comes in and buys the property at that kind of current market value, which, you know, if the original owner bought the property in the 90s, they purchased it at a much lower price, therefore able to charge much lower rents. New buyer purchases it at a much higher price, has to charge much higher rents to justify that price. And so you see, again, that type of transaction, you know, has the potential to reduce the affordability of the rental stock in the neighborhood. You see properties demolished. You know, we did a report, I think we talked to you about this earlier in the year, 2 to 4 unit buildings, you know, make up a big, you know, component of the housing stock in neighborhoods like Logan Square and, and those types of neighborhoods. Those properties often get demolished and replaced with single family homes. So that's another example of how a relatively affordable rental unit can be lost. And so in a neighborhood like Logan Square, Avondale, or the other north side neighborhoods, all these different types of market phenomenon are happening. And that's causing the steady erosion of affordability in those neighborhoods.
Yeah. So looking at this Portage Park and Jefferson Park, that area lost about 12.3% of low cost apartments. Lincoln Square and North Center lost about 11.3% of affordable apartments. And really most north side neighborhoods that saw a decline in affordable housing stock also are losing low income renters, which I thought was interesting. And look, you know, someone might hear our conversation here and say, yeah, well, no kidding. Like what you're saying makes sense. If these neighborhoods maybe are getting nicer, there are more amenities, then the property values are going to go up. People are going to buy, developers are going to buy property and then develop that and charge more. But isn't that innovation? Isn't that a good thing? But there's a flip side to this, because folks are getting priced out of these neighborhoods, some of whom have lived in these neighborhoods for generations. And that's not necessarily a great thing.
No, exactly right. I mean, you know, as you noted, you know, one of the consequences of housing prices going up is that you need to have a higher income to really be able to afford those housing prices. And therefore, you know, not surprisingly in our analysis, areas that's lost the most affordable housing also lost the most low-income renters. And then subsequently, for those low-income renters that didn't move, those neighborhoods also saw the biggest increase in the share of lower income renters and unaffordable units, which again indicates that those lower income households are more economically precarious. So, you know, exactly right. One of the, you know, the biggest challenges I think right now around housing affordability in Chicago and really in cities across the country is that as you lose the affordable supply, there's not really any mechanism in place to replace it. So in a place like Logan Square or Lincoln Square or, you know, or Albany Park, areas that are losing, you know, low, you know, more affordable housing, there's not like there's other affordable housing in the pipeline coming in to replace that housing so that low and moderate income folks can stay in the neighborhood. That steady erosion of that affordable housing is, you know, directly connected to, you know, neighborhoods becoming more exclusive and really, you know, less diverse, less economically diverse, less racially diverse. And so, you know, that's the key kind of fundamental role that affordable housing and, you know, having a diverse housing stock plays in those neighborhoods, is that they should allow for lots of diversity to thrive in those types of communities. And when you lose that affordable housing stock, you really, you know, put a lot of pressure on that diversity that really makes those neighborhoods interesting and exciting places to live.
So we're losing some of that diversity as a result of this. I mean, how do we solve this issue? Because the face of Chicago continues to change here with gentrification and the landscape here. It's definitely changing. Are there any ways that we can preserve the landscape, or at least allow for a more diverse, inclusive sort of landscape, especially when it comes to these neighborhoods on the north side?
I mean, I think that, you know, you use the word preserve, and I think preservation strategies are really, really important. When people talk about preservation, it often kind of goes to like historic preservation and preserving the historic character of a significant property. But, you know, there's another term in the affordable housing world of preservation where it's really targeted to preserving the affordability of the existing housing stock. And so, you know, really looking at programs that help support existing owners of that affordable housing, you know, the sort of low cost housing, you know, helping them maintain their property, helping them, you know, reduce their property tax burdens, potentially helping them, you know, transition that property to another owner who wants to keep it affordable at the point in time where they want to sell. You know, so there are programs out there that either exist at small scales or are sort of in development, or people are talking about, you know, ways to create these different programs and strategies to help keep that segment of the housing stock affordable in the long term. So, you know, the key is to get it to a scale that it actually, you know, makes an impact and keeps, you know, the neighborhood affordable. And that's sort of what you know, we work with this data. We try to connect it to a lot of different partners who are trying to develop those strategies so that they have data to sort of inform their work.
This report is important to understand the changing face of Chicago. It's called The State of Rental Housing in Cook County. HousingStudies.org is the website of the Institute for Housing Studies at DePaul University, and Jeff Smith is the executive director of that organization. Jeff, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and thanks for all of your hard work when it comes to housing in Chicago.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Yes, dialing up across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music on ChicagoReader.com. And I absolutely love this music. I think this is so good. And Steve, it's like country rock here. I'm going to try to pronounce the name of this band. First, I'm going to spell it. It's spelled O-U-R-A-Y. It might be pronounced Are or Ure. Whatever it is, it's really good.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I guess now that I hear you say it, I think in my head it was Ure, but I'm just not. They took the name from a Native American chief, so sadly that doesn't help as far right. as like knowing exactly how to pronounce it. But hopefully one of those is right.
Okay, this band, let's just say Ure.
All right.
They're still around. We could have, you know, we could have called them up and asked them, I suppose. But they were formed in 1975. And tell us where they come from, because they're local, forming in 1975. And again, they're just kicking out the jams.
Yeah. The band sort of, I feel like it mostly revolves around these two brothers. And there's another name that's going to be tricky to pronounce. Frank and Bo Pirocello. Let's try that. I'm going to do my best Italian there. I think that might be it. Raised in Evanston, both, you know, kind of musical kids who, you know, pretty much hopped on every, you know, the surf music, British Invasion, and then, yeah, the early country rock stuff like Poco and stuff like that they really responded to as well. Pure Prairie League, bands like that.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Poco, Pure Prairie League, and I think those bands get maybe a little airplay. There's a couple songs that are sort of a staple of classic rock radio these days, but if you dig into those albums, they're so good, and I think this is the same thing with this band, Ouray. I mean, these songs are, the harmonies are there, the music is dialed in, everything is just where it needs to be, and it's a really great listening experience.
Totally. I sort of caught wind of these guys because a member was in joined up a little later who was in that kind of more new wavy band covered a little while back, The Odd. And I was like, what, a country rock band in Chicago? Wait, they're still going? What, they got a website? And I looked them up and I was really shocked. And then I was just sort of out in the world and found the album. Great name too, Chrome on the Range. And it's got a silver foil cover where in the word chrome, and I have a special fetish for silver foil record covers. So I was like, I pretty much gasped in the middle of Half Price Books. People probably thought I was having a seizure or something, but I was like, there it is. Oh my God, there's the album. And they had two. But that's the first one, I believe, from 78, 79. And yeah, like you said, just killer country rock and sort of reflects everything country rock had done up to that point. It had sort of gone a little more jammy with the Almonds. It had sort of gone a little more like rebel rock, you know, with Skinner and 38 Special. And then there's also kind of like, you know, a gentle folkier side, like we mentioned Poco and Pure Prairie League, and even another local band that was a couple brothers, Mason Prophet, another country band. So yeah, I just feel like they sort of covered it all. And definitely one of those bands that, you know, I mean, they were even kind of poised, like in some Playboy magazine poll, they were rated best unsigned band of like 78. But yeah, you know, so it seems like there was like a wave, and they did manage to get the record, you know, two records out. And the second one you hear is really commercial as well. They were sort of going in a little more of like a new wavy power poppy kind of direction too. And you hear it and you're just like, these songs are as good as anything that was on the radio, you know, in the early 80s that, you know, had a little bit of a rootsy flair, which there wasn't too much of, you know. But yeah, I think maybe with a little better management and maybe having signed to like a bigger label, they would have been. Another band that sort of comes to mind that were local like that is Hartsfield, another band that was sort of like country-ish, rootsy, huge locally, but just didn't have those records on like huge labels or something. I'm through with you again. I told you once before and now it's true again. Writing's on the wall, I'm ready for the fall. So let's talk about locally this band Ouray. I mean, how big did they get here? Because according to what you write, they are playing some pretty significant gigs. What was the following like around here? I mean, as far as I can tell, pretty, you know, pretty big following. And yeah, they played some huge shows, and it, you know, it seems like they sort of like a variety of shows too. You know, they played with like George Thorogood, and then they played with like Pat Benatar. You know, it seems like they could throw them on a bill and it would work with two completely different, you know, kind of things, you know. So I'd say they were definitely opening pretty good shows there.
That's cool. And so like they're playing, like their gigs are pretty substantial. But like you say, they just don't break through, you know, past maybe the regional success, and that could be like a management issue or whatever, but they just can't seem to get beyond the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, they signed with like a pretty new company, you know, one that had major distribution and stuff like that, but again, I think if they had signed with a bigger, you know, label, perhaps it would have been a different story. But you know, everyone went on to continue to be in other bands, play music. The brothers own like a guitar business, basically, as far as I can tell, basically making bass guitars. So everyone has still stayed, and they still play. You know, they're playing at Space in Evanston in December. December 23rd. You can still go see these guys.
So they're still playing. They are, as you say, nowadays they have mostly music adjacent careers or in these areas. So some of these, the brothers are making bass guitars, but they're still playing. I mean, since 1975, I would love to go see that show because you got to think how tight they have to be after all these years.
Yeah, I can. And you know, I mean, it's funny. I read an interview with longtime local producer Steve Albini, and I don't agree with everything that guy says, but you know, they asked him, what is success? And you know, and he was just like, success is being able to do this for another day, and you know, and you're not a hyped flash in the pan and you're burned out and it's all done, or and you're not a, you know, like, it's like the long game basically. And I would say Ray, they have won the long game. You know, they're still doing it.
Well, you can check out the complete story of the band Ure. At least I think that's how we're pronouncing it. I think that's how you say it. It's spelled O-U-R-A-Y. So country
rock. This is definitely a check. I got to, you know, I'm writing these things and I don't think about what they sound like. This is definitely a wake up call. I gotta ask for the pronunciation next time. Gotta think ahead.
Yeah, you gotta think about, I mean, you're in print. You do the hand drawing of the musician that you're profiling, but you got to give some love to that radio. You know what I'm saying?
I will. Oh, and you know, let me hype two Secret History related events.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Right now, at the Newberry Library, there's an exhibit, 50 years of the Chicago Reader. And my editor informed me I have been with the Reader for like a third of that, which is kind of crazy to think about. You know, I was like, wait, what? So I will have a few original pieces in there, a couple original strips, along with some of the other old comic artists and such. I kind of saw what the pre-exhibit looked like, but it actually opened this last Wednesday at the Newberry. So, and I'm pretty sure it's open to the public. Also, I'm having my next little Secret History of Chicago Music residency at the Hideout on the 26th of this month. It's a Tuesday. It's early. It's a 6 o'clock thing. I'm not sure, weather permitting, I think we will move it inside if it's bad. But I'll have a couple blues experts, and we will be discussing Chicago blues. We'll be spinning the sounds and discussing. Yeah, Tuesday, the 26th at 6 p.m. at the Hideout.
I love it. You're everywhere. Hey, man. Thanks.
Phew. I'm trying.
The Secret History of Chicago Music. That's a column authored by Steve Krakow, who does some research on local musicians and bands who might not normally get their just dues. Maybe you've never heard of these bands, but boy, are they interesting, and they're really good. You could check out chicagoreader.com. Steve, as always, thank you so much for all of your hard work, and thanks for talking to us today. And you keep that peaceful, easy feeling. I know I'm crossing over here because that's the Eagles, but it's country rock, so you keep that going. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 782 is all wrapped up just for you. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Have a wonderful 3-day weekend. Enjoy the week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer today. And I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.